The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. Hold on one second. I'm coming. Welcome, welcome, welcome to a Wednesday. I lose track these days. I think I got the audio problem fixed. Thanks to everyone who tried to give me advice yesterday. Some of the advice was classic. Now, it has nothing to do with how close or far I am from the microphone. Believe me, I've been talking into a microphone for, I hate to admit it, over 40 years now. And so the mic technique is not the issue. It was a problem with the mixer, and I basically I restored it to factory settings, and hopefully whatever little glitch was in there is now fixed. It is a Tuesday. There's a ton going on right now in the House of Representatives. They are debating, before they take a vote, on the formation of a January 6th commission along the lines of the 9/11 commission. And it's something, of course, that they need to do. I mean, we know what happened on January 6th. And, you know, the Republicans are playing political games with it because they're afraid of what is going to come out, the findings of this commission, and that it will impact them when it comes to the 2022 midterm elections. And oh well, that would be just too bad. Anyway, so they're debating it now. I thought they were going to be starting the vote at 5 Eastern, but when I turned it on just moments ago, Nancy Pelosi was talking, and I thought she was finishing the debate, but I think she was just starting it, because then Marjorie Taylor Greene spoke, and I was going to record it, and I couldn't listen. So anyway, here we are. It is Tuesday, and I'm sorry, it is Wednesday. I get the days mixed up. It's old age setting in. Anyway, so today we're talking about war. To quote the song, because I can't play it, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. And yet we're constantly mired in them. In fact, our second guest today is going to tell us that in the nation's 245-year history, we've had 11 years in which we were at peace. 11 years. So we'll question David Vine about that. He's the author of the book, The United States of War. We'll talk to him. But first, you know, I spoke a bit about it the last couple of days and what's going on with Israel and the Palestinian people who are, I was going to say living on the Gaza Strip, but living is putting it, giving them more credit. Things are really bad there. And today we heard reports that Joe Biden again spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu this morning. And after they spoke, in which Biden told him, you need to, like, you know, ramp things down because things are getting bad and this can't go on much longer. You need to have a significant de-escalation. And so that came out in the news, right? And then allegedly after that conversation and the readout, in which we're told that Biden told Netanyahu that he needs to enact a significant de-escalation, Netanyahu said that it was, quote, not possible to set a time frame on the operation, and said that and I don't have the actual quote here. But basically said, we're going to keep going until we accomplish what we want to accomplish, or some such nonsense. And then allegedly there was a third phone call in which President Biden conveyed to the Prime Minister that he expected. I must be confused about this. I don't know if they spoke twice today or once, but either way, it appears that Netanyahu is ignoring the advice given to him by Joe Biden. So I wanted to bring in somebody who's a little more well-versed on what goes on in Israel than I am. Obviously, you know, the people who listen to the show know me. I'm Jewish by heritage. I'm kind of an atheist Jew. But I appreciate the traditions and the history. And I do feel that Israel has a right to exist. And there's a need for a place like Israel based on history. But how they are behaving right now is quite reprehensible. So that's my views. Now let me bring in somebody with his own viewpoint. So we go to the phone. I've got audio playing on there and I need to bring it down. Hold on 1 second, Ron, because, I know it's coming from here. Okay. Now I was hearing the debate from the from C-SPAN that bled through. Ron Skolnick joins us. He is an American. Is it proper to call you an American Israeli? Do you have dual citizenship?
I do. I grew up American, but lived for 25 years in Israel.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And you are the, I want to get this right, communications consultant for Partners for Progressive Israel. You can find them at progressiveisrael.org. A former political analyst for the British Embassy in Israel. You're a graduate of Tel Aviv University. You have an MA in diplomatic and military history. So you're well-versed in the politics of the region. And just your initial reaction when you heard the missiles started flying again between Gaza and Israel, what was your first thought?
My first thought was that what some people in Israel had been warning about for several weeks, that Netanyahu had been looking to stir up a bit of a provocation, centering it on East Jerusalem, had finally sort of reached its, and I don't want to say Netanyahu wished for the number of rockets that have hit Israel, but a lot of people were very concerned that he was going to cook up a little something in order to, because a lot of what's going on that the American media is not paying attention to is the intersection between Israeli domestic politics and the Israel-Palestine situation. Just so happens that on the day that Hamas launched its rockets, two political figures in Israel had reportedly agreed to set up a new coalition that would replace Netanyahu. Now, the coalition that was to replace Netanyahu was not going to be a left-wing coalition.
Right.
A significant part or significant minority of right-wing MKs have sort of turned away from what Netanyahu represents in terms of his threats to democracy. And they were going to sort of make common cause, a left-right-center coalition, for the express purpose of ending the Netanyahu period. It wasn't going to be a revolution in foreign policy, but it was going to be an advancement, essentially, in terms of Israeli democracy and hopefully Israeli society. The day that was supposed to happen, Hamas launched its rockets. A lot of people are not talking about pre-planning between Netanyahu and Hamas. Certainly, that would, you know, that is not at all what I'm saying. But
okay,
the escalation that preceded the actual fighting is something that people have been looking at for many weeks as is Netanyahu cooking something up.
Right, which
maybe
is
not to this degree. And so that was just sort of my initial feeling, besides feelings of concern for the people involved, was just an exasperation that Netanyahu, who's been interim prime minister now for, I believe it's a year and a half, or over a year,
right,
is going to continue. And very soon after that, one of the right-wing partners in this would-be alternative coalition basically said, no, I can't do this anymore. There's too, you know, because that alternate coalition was going to be reliant on a small party called the United Arab List.
Okay.
And that's been anathema for right-wing parties. And it was sort of a breakthrough that they were even letting this group support this alternative coalition. And when the fighting started, one of the right-wing parties that's opposed in it or was not necessarily going to go with Netanyahu backed away from that. And that seems to have undermined any effort in the meantime to put together an alternative coalition. And Israel will likely go to a fifth round of elections within less than 2 years.
That blows my mind. And actually, I'm going to be out tomorrow and I'm looking for a best of show to play. And back, it was September of 2019 in that last election when Netanyahu looked like he lost. And I just go on how things work over here. And I like to call other countries and talk to like regular people to get their take rather than take the what the media reports as a word or certainly the word of the government. And what I tend to do is call hotels because people are more apt to speak English. And I called a hotel in Tel Aviv and I got the most wonderful clerk who we were having a party, basically a Transcontinental Party, and the fact that it looked like Netanyahu was out. And here he still is, and he loses the next election, and he's still there. It's a mind-blowing, I thought our system of government was broken, but that's pretty foobar. I surmised the other day that one of the reasons that that Netanyahu is ramping up the hostilities is because simply this reason, he wants to stay in power. So I'm not that far off base.
I don't live in the soul of Bibi Netanyahu.
Gotcha.
But a lot of folks on the center, not only on the left in Israel, but the center left, have been pointing to a very suspicious coincidence between tensions. And again, the tensions were building up in the weeks before Hamas fired its rockets at Israeli civilians, I will note. But tensions were building up in East Jerusalem throughout the month of April.
Right,
are you off? I can't guarantee that you and I are right, but yes, it was something that folks were warning about, and the timing coincidence doesn't make me feel good.
Right. Now, depending on what media you're listening to, they will say, well, you know, the Palestinians, Hamas on the Gaza Strip, they fired rockets into Israel, thus starting the hostilities. But as you mentioned, the hostilities were ramping up. Tensions were high already because in this East Jerusalem neighborhood, where Palestinians have lived for generations, once again, there are hard right, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I defer to you on all of this, but Israel was looking at settling some Israelis, hard right Israeli citizens in this neighborhood where the Palestinians were leaving, basically evicting them and taking over this settlement. Is my vernacular right, or tell me what the real story is?
Right. So Israel has a law from, I think it's 1970, if not it's the early 70s, that, you know, Israel, there was the war in 1967, Israel took over the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and it expanded what were then the boundaries of Jerusalem in order to annex that part. And after the annexation, Israel passed a law that basically said, if Jews had held land in East Jerusalem prior, you know, during the 1948, prior to the division in practice of Jerusalem at that time between Israel and Jordan, if there was Jewish ownership, the Jews have a right to reclaim that land. That land and or that property. There was no parallel law that Palestinian, because there had been Jews in East Jerusalem prior to the 48 war. They left, they fled, they were evicted, you know, by Jordanian forces. But there were also Palestinians in West Jerusalem who fled or were evicted, or, you know, that's what happens in wars. There was no parallel law in Israel saying, well, in West Jerusalem, Palestinians are able to reclaim land or property that they left behind. So it was a highly discriminatory law that the Israeli foreign ministry, they're trying to pass off what's going on in East Jerusalem as a real estate dispute. You know, they didn't pay their rent, we're kicking them out. But fact of the matter is, you know, if you look at the people who were there, there are Jewish, far-right Jewish organizations who are seeking the historic owners of these properties, not in order to move in another Palestinian family from another part of the city. They're looking to bring in Jews and where they can, working through this Israeli law, get rid of the Palestinian families there. It's part of East Jerusalem. You know, it's a neighborhood of East Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, and a lot of Jews have a different name for it based on you know, legacy of Jewish ties to the area. But notwithstanding historical and cultural ties, yes, there's an effort by right-wing organizations to, wherever they can, to push out, through the force of law, mind you, push out Palestinian
their
families.
Their law, right.
I believe it's about 2,000 families either affected or could be affected.
So that was the impetus. That's what started this round of hostilities, is their efforts to evict the Palestinians who've lived there for decades at least, and for Jewish settlers to come in. And this has been a bone of contention going back, you know, forever, where the settlements. So that's how the fighting started. That's what got it started. So now here we are. We're, what, 11 or 12 days into it. You heard me mess up the news story. I don't know if Netanyahu spoke with Biden once today or twice. Either way, Biden apparently is stepping up his demand that Israel significantly de-escalate the situation, and Netanyahu's saying, yeah, maybe not. And that's where we are today. So I'm not sure where we go from here. I just wanted to talk to somebody who's got a firm grip on the region, because there is, it's a lose-lose situation. And in fact, I think both sides are at fault here. Now, the situation in the Gaza Strip, that is commonly referred to as the world's largest open-air prison. People who are relegated to live there can't leave. They can't go out and fish in the sea. They can't go into Israel or go into Egypt when they're not allowed. They have a hard time getting supplies. Yet, they are ruled by Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. So when we were talking about you coming on, and I said one of the questions I wanted to ask you is why Hamas? Why Hamas? I mean, did the Palestinian people, the residents of Gaza, are they just in bed with them because they're there? Or how did this this political situation come to be in Gaza?
Well, look, I mean, I strongly encourage you. I think that one of the problems in the American media is that not enough Palestinian voices are heard, especially from Gaza and the West Bank. Mm-hmm. I'm going to shy away a little bit from describing, because I'm not Palestinian.
Right.
I don't live within Palestinian society. There's a long and just as complicated as Israeli history is a long and complicated Palestinian political history of elections,
sure,
of efforts to, of civil war, essentially, between Hamas and Fatah, which Fatah, the party of Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, lost. Reported efforts of Israel and the U.S. to try to side with Hamas. This goes back to, 15 years ago, to that period after Israel pulled out its troops from Gaza. I can tell you what I read as an informed observer or somewhat informed observer of Palestinian society, that the old guard of Fatah, which was the primary party in the PLO, had become stale and corrupt and nepotistic. It had also not delivered the goods. It basically had once engaged in military operations, including terrorism, and then, late 80s, early 90s, had basically said, we're going to throw in our lot with this idea that we can harness international political pressure, and we seem to have maybe a partner in Israel. We're going to try to reach a diplomatic solution. And that's predominantly what they became, a two-state, via diplomatic and political channels. And when that fell apart, and that's 2000, 2001, I'm talking about the Intifada, and the peace process fell apart, they had very little left. I imagine, again, I'm sure there are plenty of Palestinian commentators who
sure.
can comment
right.
on this
okay.
much more successfully
gotcha.
Than I. But I'm sure, but just the same way that the Labor Party in Israel sort of lost its luster when it had become sort of the party that represented the Oslo process, and that fell apart, and the Labor Party shriveled into about one sixth the size of what it once had been. Fatah also failed to deliver the goods on what it promised, which was cessation of violence in return for diplomatic gains, and that never panned out.
Okay, right. All right, so let's talk about something different. The solution to this problem, and what's widely talked about as the solution, is the two-state solution. Split Jerusalem, give the Palestinians their homeland, Israelis their homeland, and I know I'm oversimplifying it, but that's basically it. What is the feeling of the average Israeli on the street, or is there an average Israeli on the street? How do people there feel about what's going on and the situation as it currently stands?
In terms of the two-state solution?
Yeah, and how they are now.
I think that the last 10, 15, almost I'd say 20 years has been classically, Israelis are for a two-state solution, but they don't trust the other side to implement it in a way that would give them peace.
Mm-hmm.
And once upon a time, saying two-state solution in Israel was, you know, that was way beyond the pale. You couldn't say that. That was traitorous.
Oh, wow.
I'm talking 1970s, 1980s.
Okay. Right.
Only in the 1990s did it sort of become, if not the majority, at least it was mainstream. And so more Israelis were saying it, and I think they believed it in the 90s. Let's not go down. There's a whole path of who mucked things up in the 90s. I think there's a lot of people that deserve credit for that one, too.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Intifada, there was a sense of, well, sure, we want to have a two-state solution, but look how violent they are. And you know, look, I lived in Israel during a time when we would, you know, we would think about what cafe to go to based on what chances we would have to survive a blast if somebody walked in.
Wow.
You know, I stopped taking buses at one point because I'm said, you know what, I'll pay taxis. It's just not worth not worth the risk. So Israelis were living in proper fear. Sometimes I hear people further to my left, let's say, who I think there's a definite huge power imbalance between Israel and Palestine, or the forces in Palestine. You know, that doesn't undermine the actual fear that people feel on the Israeli side, and that doesn't, and I'm not seeking to diminish at all the huge fear that Gazans are going to sleep in. But Israeli fear is real, and it's kind of a PTSD, and I think people are still scared from the Second Intifada of having their normal lives sort of put in danger like that, of buses blowing up, of restaurants blowing up. So I think that's where Israelis stand. Little by little, even that sort of small majority that was like a 55, typically like a 55, 60% majority for a two-state solution, that's been slipping in recent years. And that's 10, 12 years of Netanyahu in power. And the right is becoming, gradually has sort of undermined that as a, you know, as a realistic option. And so people are starting to drift away. And you are seeing smaller but still significant sections of people saying, yeah, we can just maintain this situation forever. Or we can have one state here, but the Palestinians won't have rights. Those are not yet majority viewpoints in the polls, but they're there. And a lot of people are just saying, you know, I don't like it, but what else are we going to do? This is the best we can do right now. Hopefully we'll get eventually to a better situation.
And do you think that's possible as long as Netanyahu's still in power?
I mean, Netanyahu doesn't believe that there's a solution with the Palestinians. He's made that clear. You can disagree with him, you can agree with him, but that's sort of the honest truth. He went through the motions when Barack Obama was president, and John Kerry was visiting, and he said two-state solution, and he sort of talked. He attached conditions to it that. He kind of said it, but he attached so many conditions that it seemed, no, he doesn't really. But when Donald Trump came to power, he made it clear that he doesn't believe in anything approaching what, let's call the international community, what we used to think of as a two-state solution. So then his goal is, well, if there's no two-state solution, what's the most tenable way that I can manage the conflict? He doesn't. I don't think he believes in solving the conflict.
No.
And I think a lot of Israelis have endorsed, in one form or another, that approach of managing the conflict. And I think, to an extent, this idea. Look, IDF head of operations was interviewed on Israel News the other day, and they said, "What's a success?" Because a lot of Israelis themselves are asking, like, "What are we trying to do here?" And he said, well, a success would be 5 years or more of quiet.
Wow.
So that's sort of the approach, in a sense, is we're going to do one of these every 5, 6, 7, for lucky 10 years.
Yeah.
But that's the best that we can expect.
Oh, wow. I hear you. I hear you. Now I need to, I'm going to ask you one last question, and it comes from Pam in San Bernardino, who texted this. And I like Pam, and I'm not going to use profanity towards you, Pam, but she wrote, you'll probably use profanity towards me, but I don't care. You need to stop calling Hamas a terrorist organization. It's the usually American playbook of demonization. What do you say to that?
You know, my answer is not going to be yes or no, but I'll say that if Hamas sent somebody with a suicide vest into a bus of people to blow it up,
that's a terrorist.
That makes it a terrorist organization in my eyes. Mm-hmm. And if that, if 25 years ago, when I was living those things personally, is too far ago, then, you know, shooting rockets at cities where non-combatants live makes it a terrorist organization. Now, what I don't buy necessarily is the idea that if Hamas wasn't doing this, no, what I don't buy at all is if Hamas wasn't doing this, all of a sudden there would be peace. No.
Right. Somebody
no.
else.
No. In fact, Netanyahu is very comfortable with Hamas as a political enemy. It's much easier than saying no to somebody who's saying, sure, let's share the land, two-state solution, confederation. Mm-hmm. Now, does Hamas, through its actions, represent the frustrations and fears and lack of freedom of Palestinians? Absolutely. Does that mean that the means it uses put it outside the definition of terrorism? I'm not a jurist. I don't think so. Human Rights Watch today, Ken Roth said, look, the Palestinians, the Hamas are terrorists. Just what Israel's doing doesn't excuse that, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
What Hamas does doesn't excuse any war crimes that Israel commits.
I agree.
I'm not, but no, I have no problem saying Hamas is a terrorist organization.
Okay.
I don't play by the mainstream media playbook.
Gotcha.
In fact, I find the mainstream media appalling often, but no, I mean, yeah, I find it hard to stomach the idea that Hamas would be labeled as not terrorists
right.
and political actors.
And I make a point of differentiating between Hamas and the Palestinian people and the people imprisoned in the Gaza Strip. I think they're different entities. I'm sure there's some overlap, but not all of it. And that's why I asked, why Hamas? Because I know there are people who don't ascribe to their ideology, but yet they're the ones who are running the show over there.
Yeah, look, not everybody who voted, just the way that not everybody who voted for Trump is a Trumpist. Not everybody who voted for Hamas, and going back, this is 15, 16 years ago, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the Israeli PR outlets tried to say, oh, look, they're all Hamas.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people said, you know what, the Fatah, they're a bunch of corrupt politicians, let's try something else. The same way that people said, let's try something else in 2016 in the U.S. I'm differentiating between 16 and 20. You know, people have all sorts of motivations for voting who they vote for. But in terms of the Hamas as an institution, no. Does Hamas have a political wing? Sure. Do they make political calculations? Absolutely. Might they live in some sort of detente with Israel? Yeah. I don't buy into the argument that they're constantly going to be shooting because they're so filled with hatred that they can't stop. Because they do stop.
Mm-hmm.
There's a political calculus to all this. That doesn't mean that their selection or their absence of selection of targets isn't terrorism. But are they operating within a political realm? Sure. And Israel needs to reach, because Israel is sort of, there's right now no PLO, Palestinian Authority, operating in Gaza. So Israel needs to reach some sort of detente, including opening up Gaza and relieving the situation of the people there.
Yeah.
That's absolutely. And so in that sense, Pam is right in the sense of, I don't agree that, they're terrorists, so no conversation with them.
Right.
Or no deals with them. That's ridiculous. They are a political outfit as well. They're running an area. It's not a state, but it's some, they're running
something.
A territorial area and trying to meet needs. So Israel needs to make a deal at some sort, whether it's through third party or direct. I don't think anybody really cares, except for the politicians themselves.
I hear you. I gotcha. No, it is a weird situation there. It's far from ideal, but it is what's in place now, and that's what it is. Ron Skolnick, I could ask you questions for probably hours, because obviously I am not well-versed on what's going over there, and part of it is my own... You know, I put blinders up. Part of it is I don't want to say ashamed. I just can't stand Netanyahu and the way he's governing things. And while Trump was in power, I could easily say, look, I just as I disagree with our government here and I disavow it, that's how I feel about Israel's government. I just think after you lose an election four times, you should be booted out of office. So that's me. Anyway, I got to run because I got another guest coming up. But Ron Skolnick, thank you so much. And if anyone's wondering how how we connected, we went to elementary school together back in Bayside, New York. And I'm going to embarrass you, but you're on the phone. You can't see it. This is our second grade class picture. That's you in the back row. You're the,
I look nothing like that right now.
You're the second from the teacher in the back row. And me, I'm in the front row, right in the center. I'm the really adorable one with the little headband there. Second grade. And what else I noticed is, we are really old because this photo is in black and white. Now, I did notice I have my third grade class picture, and the third grade picture was in color. So we were right on the cutting edge there.
Right. Can I just say one more thing before
you
boot me off?
Absolutely.
Listen, Secretary of State Blinken said something recently that was really important as a guideline. He said Israelis and Palestinians are entitled to equal measures of freedom, dignity, prosperity, and security. Right now, they have to put that into practice, though.
Right.
Those were great words. I really think that was a great guideline. And regardless of what the political future will be and how they'll configure government of the area between the river and the sea, that principle has to be implemented, right away.
Let me ask you one last question, then.
If not
for us, if the United States wasn't such a strong ally of Israel and sending an inordinate, frankly, obscene amount of money every month, would the situation still be the same, do you think?
I think Israel can live without the U.S. aid.
Right.
I think Israel probably would be more affected by the U.S. withdrawing political support or political interference sometimes than the actual aid. Israel has a very robust economy.
Right. So why are we sending them so much money?
That's a whole other question that I'm not, sort of like outside my
wheelhouse.
My expertise, yes,
gotcha.
In terms of the, U.S.-Israel alliance and the history of those things. But I think the fact that the U.S. is, repeating the old talking points of self-defense, which Israel does have a right to self-defense, but leading with that and making that the centerpiece rather than looking at, again, the equal measures of dignity, freedom, prosperity, and security that both sides deserve, which I think should be like leading every statement that that they make about what's going on. That's I think is a big problem. I think things are changing. I just think the Biden administration hasn't completely caught up with the program yet.
No, I think you're right on that one. Ron Skolnick, thanks so much. People can follow you on Twitter at Ron_Skolnick, Skolnick. I'll link to it from the blog where I post today's show at NicoleSandler.com. And also check out Progressive Partners for Progressive Israel at ProgressiveIsrael.org. Thank you so much, Ron. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks so much,
we'll
Nicole.
Talk again soon. I appreciate it.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
No problem.
Bye-bye. All right. So we are talking war today because, you can't escape it. And so we're going to move right along to our next guest. And his name is David Vine. David Vine is an author. In fact, hi, David. Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Nicole.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You can tell from, I got to move this picture. From what you heard of the last conversation, I was talking with an old friend of mine, someone who, is an American Israeli citizen, dual citizenship, about what's going on over there. And it's just one more battle that United States has its tentacles in, one of many, and that's what you write about. The new book is, or the recent book, the latest book, is The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. And this is actually the third in a series that you've written about our life with war, yes?
That's exactly right, yeah. But I don't mean the United States of War, the title of the book, as a metaphor. I mean that the United States as a country, really since independence, but in profound ways in the last 20 years, has become a country defined by war, and that our lives, our everyday lives in ways both seen and unseen, have become profoundly defined by war.
Right. And in fact, you have in the book a series of maps. And one, I'm going to put one up on the screen right now that's just in your face. This says the Empire of the United States of America. And it shows a completely red United States map and a lot of other territories. And so what are we looking at here? What is this telling us?
Well, I'm so glad you found it and enjoy it. Really, in a certain way, this map was inspired by the kinds of children's placemats that one sees or maps that children get to draw in. But typically, when it comes to the United States, defines the United States as the 50 states. Sometimes they don't even bother to include Alaska and Hawaii. So it's just the 48 contiguous states. This map attempts to more honestly depict what the United States is. And that is, first and foremost, an empire, and that the United States, the book shows, has been an empire since independence. But today, the empire of the United States looks like the 50 states that many are familiar with, plus the seven colonies that people often overlook. Frequently, they're called territories. I called them territories for a long time. And I've given up on that, as of many people who live in these colonies, because they are in a colonial relationship with the rest of the United States. And we're talking about Puerto Rico and Guam, American Samoa, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Washington, D.C., my hometown, which has slightly more power than the other colonies. And then Guantanamo Bay, which people often forget about entirely. They might think about the prison when there's some momentum finally to close the prison years after President Obama promised to do so. But people forget about the rest of the base. It's about the size of Washington, D.C., in fact, and is a colony. It's plopped down in the middle of Cuba, and the United States has held it since 1903.
Wow. So we are, this is an empire, right? And as much as, you know, many may protest the language, the vernacular, that's what it is. We conquer territories and it's an empire. Afghanistan had been known as the graveyard of empires. It bears some responsibility for the breaking apart of the Soviet Union, doesn't it? Their invasion of Afghanistan, if my history is correct. And so we went in, and it is now America's longest war. Obviously, there was no exit strategy. We got in there because George W. Bush, who was a doofus of the nth degree, who probably never thought anything through except that maybe he was going to enrich himself and his oil buddies in invading Afghanistan and Iraq. Maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but I tend to do that. But we've spent 20 years there. Did nobody consider that it is the graveyard of empires?
Apparently not carefully enough. I think they were caught up in their own power and in a kind of hubris that has often been the downfall of empires for millennia. I think, you know, the George W. Bush administration, whatever their motivations and whatever they're thinking at the time, I think we have to recognize that the decisions they made and put into effect, which were then perpetuated by Presidents Obama and Trump, it's important to note, for the most part, perpetuated. The decisions the George W. Bush administration made after the attacks of 9/11 have been catastrophic beyond words, catastrophic for the countries in which the United States military has been fighting and catastrophic for the United States itself. Again, often in ways that people aren't sadly aware enough about, largely because the costs of these wars for the United States have been paid for with a credit card. That is, the United States has taken on tremendous debt that will be paid off for generations to come, or certainly for years and years to come, rather than in the past, U.S. wars have been fought by raising taxes, so people felt them immediately. So if you didn't have a member of your family or weren't yourself in the military, in many ways, people were, their lives were very distant from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. It went over the border in Yemen and Somalia and Libya, in the Philippines. U.S. military personnel have been fighting in at least 25 countries since 2001. So the wars, plural, that the Bush administration launched were not just those in Iraq and Afghanistan, but were a really global war. And it's important to note that, you know, sometimes, especially so many years later, people tend to think these wars were inevitable. These wars were never inevitable. These wars were a matter of choice. The George W. Bush administration had other choices that it could have made in responding to the attacks of 9/11, namely, and most importantly, responding to them as the crimes that they were. And research shows that, in fact, responses to terrorist acts that it take the form of criminal justice responses and intelligence gathering responses right. are far more effective than the use of war, which tends, as has been the case in the global war on terror, to create more terrorists, to create more sure. people who would use terrorism as a tool. The threat of militants who would use terrorist acts against the United States and others around the world is far greater today than it was on 9/11.
Oh, without a doubt. And in fact, I mean, if you remember the whole thing about, and it's 20 years ago now, so it's a bit foggy, pardon the old age here. But that, you know, what we realized was Osama bin Laden wanted to hurt American society to take us down. And I would say he was successful. Everything here changed. After the 9/11 attacks, we got the Patriot Act, which truly infringed on our civil liberties. And we went into this war mode, and so much more. Everything got bad after that. And it's because of the constraints that we put on ourselves, kind of in response to what they did. And I would say that he got exactly what he wanted. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I don't think you are. I think the U.S. government gave bin Laden and al-Qaeda exactly what they wanted. Yeah. They gave them a war. They gave them a platform. And they gave them a kind of publicity that was greater than they could have ever dreamed about. And that only helped in their recruitment. And research, again, shows that the presence of, in fact, U.S. bases and troops, whatever they're doing, frequently aids the recruitment of militant groups that use terrorism as a tactic. We should be specific though about who made these decisions. Yes, it was the George W. Bush administration. It mm-hmm. wasn't, of course, the royal or global we.
Right.
But there were plenty of Democrats who got in line, literally got in line behind the Bush administration and enabled these wars and cheerled these wars. And sadly, far too many of the folks who were cheerleaders throughout these wars or directed them are still in positions of power. I think there are many signs that thinking about how the United States engages with the world, thinking about U.S. foreign policy, is in the process of a very significant transformation. Basic principles of U.S. foreign policy are being questioned, like that of maintaining literally hundreds of military bases today, around 800 military bases outside the 50 states in Washington, D.C. And that's the other thing that my map, the Empire of the United States, depicts, not just the colonies, not just the states, but also the military bases that the United States government has used to encircle the globe and which has fueled and enabled these long series of wars, now 20 years of war. And an even longer history of war, as my book details, the last 20 years of war actually aren't all that exceptional at all.
Wow.
My research has shown that the United States military has fought in every year in U.S. history, with
Except
the exception 11? Of 11.
11. Yeah. I saw that. I was going to ask you about that. What were the 11 years that we weren't involved in a war?
There were a few years in the 1930s. There were a few years in the 1950s and a few at the end of the 19th century. But by some estimates, the United States has never been at peace. And in certain senses, of course, the United States has never been at peace. So there are longer term patterns that are directly connected to the blueprint for the United States that the founders envisioned. And that was modeling the United States after the European empires of
Wow.
the day.
Wow.
And the United States has continued to be an empire into the present, and although it has transformed over time. But I think what's important to focus on now is transforming that empire. And one of the things my book calls for is a process of de-imperialization. And this can sound, I mean, it can sound radical to some to even call the United States an empire, let alone to call for de-imperializing the United States. But I fear, and your comments earlier alluded to it, that if we don't dramatically transform the United States and transform how we engage with the rest of the world, and thus also how we, of course, pursue policy domestically. Mm-hmm. If we don't, we will, like empires past, crumble in either bankruptcy or absolute abject destruction or some combination of the two.
Right. I agree with you on all this. Again, David Vine is our guest. His latest book is The United States of War. And again, it's the third in a series. The other two, one is dealing with bases. It's a base nation, how U.S. military bases abroad harm America and the world. And you talked about that. And you have a lot of maps in this book. So I showed you the one, the Empire one. This is one on U.S. military bases abroad in 2020. This was from last year. So it shows how we are everywhere. And I bring this up to point out that, you know, I don't agree with Donald Trump on anything. And I don't trust his motivations for anything that he did. So when he talked about, we find out now that after he lost the election, he tried to order the military to withdraw from everywhere around the world. Now, as much as I'd like to see us withdraw from around the world, obviously that's not the way you do it. You have to do it in a organized manner so to have the least harm, to affect the least harm on the nations that we are ostensibly aiding by being there. Donald Trump just wants to blow things up and aggrandize himself or whatever. That's the wrong move, but that's the right goal to have, isn't it?
Ultimately, it is, and there are people across the political spectrum who've now come to that same conclusion, and Trump is a sign. He's not, I mean, he's an aberration in some ways, but generally speaking, he's actually quite reflective of larger trends. And with the case of bases abroad, he's a reflection of growing questioning among Republicans and libertarians, as well as people on the left, like myself, who are questioning why the United States is maintaining around 800 bases in around 80 countries and colonies around the world, and whether this, in fact, is protecting the United States or protecting anyone in the world. These bases are tremendously costly, and that's often why people on the right are critical of them. Upwards of $51 billion a year goes to just maintain and run these bases, let alone the troops that we need to pay to be stationed on them. And of course, this is money that could be spent elsewhere. It could be spent elsewhere by the military to protect the borders of the United States, to protect the United States itself. And of course, it could be used, as so much of the military budget should be, to address domestic needs that have gone so wanting. These bases abroad have not, of course, protected us against COVID or other pandemics. Spending $6.4 trillion, that's the total cost of the post 9/11 wars, just as of last October. So now that it's inching closer to $7 trillion that US taxpayers have spent to wage war since 2001. We need to think about not just the horrific waste that entails, but also what could we have done with $7 trillion? Similarly, what could we do with the money that we're spending to build and maintain this hugely robust infrastructure of bases abroad that so frequently damage the places where they're located and frequently inflame military tensions? I think one of the things that map and others in the book attempt to do is to encourage people in the United States in particular to think about how would we feel if we were surrounded by Chinese bases or Russian bases or Iranian bases. There isn't a single base belonging to Russia or China or Iran anywhere near the borders of the United States. Meanwhile, there are literally hundreds surrounding each of those countries, as well as North Korea, of course. We should not be surprised if those countries and their leaders feel threatened by the presence of our bases near their borders. We would feel threatened too, and we would likely respond militarily in some fashion. U.S. bases abroad are not just enabling war, not just making war possible, but actually making war more likely in a whole variety of ways. And that's one of my deepest fears, of course, right now, is the potential for a war between the United States and China. And there are far too many completely irresponsible U.S. leaders, military leaders, civilian leaders who are talking about the inevitability of war with China, which should be horrifically frightening to us.
Absolutely.
These two nuclear-armed powers, the two wealthiest countries on Earth, the idea of even a minimal clash is beyond frightening. And we should not pretend or fantasize that a conflict could be contained to just some sort of minimal clash. The disregard for human lives, military lives and civilian lives, is, again, beyond frightening.
Well, it's true. And it goes even further, because the idealist in me, which is pretty strong in the many facets, says, Joe Biden just increased in his budget the amount that we're spending on military. And it's $700 and some odd billion. It's obscene. And yet Congress is fighting over helping people who are legitimately hurting since this pandemic, people who are at risk of losing everything they ever had because they lost their job due to this pandemic. They are fighting relief efforts here at home, but they give a free credit card to for the war effort. When do we change the way we think? And I'm hoping it's with this next generation, because they seem to be engaged and are not willing to stand for things, for the status quo, the way things have been.
I think that's exactly right. I have a lot of hope for the next generations, although we need urgently to change things
before,
now.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't, folks in older generations don't get a pass. We urgently need to transform this system of war, a system of really permanent war. The Biden administration's announcement of the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan is a good sign.
Right.
And he's doing it in a more responsible way than Trump attempted to.
Yes.
Part of what my call and the call of people who are part of a transpartisan left-right coalition of academics and think tank types and activists and others who are calling for the closure of bases abroad, we're saying, we need to close bases abroad. We need to end the endless wars, but we have to do so in a responsible way, first and foremost by building up our diplomatic presence and diplomatic tools while we draw down our bases and while we end the endless wars. But we do have to go far beyond the war in Afghanistan, because U.S. troops are operating in and fighting in many other countries. We need not just to end these wars, but again, to fundamentally transform how U.S. leaders and the country thinks about security and how we think about how we engage with the world. And when it comes to security, I think there are, again, as you pointed out, people in the younger generations who see that security begins at home. It begins with the horrific debt that college students are in right now. It begins with having healthcare, no matter whether you have a job or not. It begins with a proper high school and elementary school and pre-K education. It begins with the infrastructure and affordable housing in our communities that has been neglected for literally decades.
Absolutely.
As we've been building up a war economy.
We have 1 in 5 children in this country go to bed hungry at night. This is the wealthiest nation on the planet in the history of the world. And we don't even have the oil reserves that they do in the Middle East. But we have more money, and yet you would think we're in dire straits because we can't afford, basic health care for our citizens. Well, we can't afford it. We can afford anything we want. We can't afford it all. And we'd be able to afford a whole lot more if we stop pouring billions and trillions of dollars into the military. The only problem is there are some who say, and we're not going to have time to get into this whole subject. This opens a whole other can of worms, but our military industrial complex is a huge jobs program. We're going to have to replace the jobs of all those people. And hey, wouldn't a Green New Deal and Biden's new infrastructure jobs plan work perfectly in that scenario? You can replace the jobs of all the military contractors, all the people who work building weapon systems that we shouldn't be selling to Israel or Saudi Arabia or anyone else for that matter. But it's going to take a huge shift in the way this country thinks. And unfortunately, we have this Republican Party that hopefully, my guest on Friday, if he's right, they will be decimated in 2022, and then we'll be able to move along and do what we need to do. But we have to be involved. And David Vine, I'm rushing because we're getting close to the hour. On your website at davidvine.net, under the new book heading, you have a subheading called Taking Action. And you have a lot of movements, a lot of peace organizations that people can join in. I worry that because we don't have the draft, So our kids aren't being sent off, pulled from our homes, as in Vietnam, that we're not feeling the pain. We don't have bases right here. We haven't had a hit except for 9/11 on American soil and Pearl Harbor, but that was Hawaii. So we don't feel the pain. So we're not, we don't feel like it's there. And America, you know, has blinders on. The show graphic I used for today is this old poster that I remember because I'm old from the 70s. The war is not healthy for children and other living things. And it, that kind of activism seems to have been forgotten. Maybe we need a new anti-war movement or a beefed up one. We need people to stand up and say enough already.
We do. We need more people to stand up and say enough already in whatever fashion. No, I think the defund the police movement is something of a model.
The messaging is horrible because I'm sorry, I agree with the sentiment that we need to change the way police work, but you have a whole swath of this nation who's defund the police. Get rid of those commie crazy people. We need the police. We need better police. We need police who don't, you know,
I don't want to distract from this. Gotcha. My point there was just to say that we need to think as broadly as possible.
Yes.
To transform fundamentally the role of the military in our society.
Most definitely.
Your poster is right on point, of course. And I think to connect to what you said about the military industrial complex, we need to remember that Eisenhower showed us the danger of the military industrial complex and showed us that military spending on war, is a kind of theft. And I think we need to go back to that and show people that they are being directly damaged by war, even if they aren't feeling it. The COVID pandemic has had such terrible effects, not just because of President Trump's incompetence and neglect, but also because we've spent decades investing in war, in the military, not in pandemic preparedness.
That's right.
Not in public health, not in universal health care. We need this sort of level of transformation. And I do think that calling for a national draft, a reinstitution of the draft, actually, and perhaps a bit counterintuitively, would be a good idea to make people feel more directly the effects of war.
That's right, because then everyone's got, quote, skin in the game. Because your kid could be called up for service. And then all of a sudden, then it's real. And for too many Americans, it's not real. And it falls on the economically disadvantaged, those who need a way out, so they join the military. It is a way to, you know, earn a living and be taken care of and have your immediate future charted. Well, unless you get sent to an active war zone and killed. But yeah, it takes the burden of feeling the personal effects of war away from the very few unfortunate Americans who do feel it, to put it on everyone. I'd like to see some of these members of Congress have their kids be called up to war, and then maybe they'll have a change in attitude when it comes to voting for that war funding.
Absolutely. I think they should also pay attention to the, you know, people make the jobs argument about investing in the military and the Pentagon and in war. War spending is a really poor economic strategy. Uh-huh. It's a really poor job creator. Yes, it does create many jobs, but we can create far more jobs if we invest the same amount of money in healthcare or education or infrastructure. So I think we need to make that point and show people that this is a really short-sighted and really deleterious kind of an investment in our economy and certainly in our well-being and the well-being of people around the world, and needs urgent transformation.
You got it. The book is The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. I'll put a link up on the blog where I post today's show with all the information about the book. And David, you can find on Twitter at David S. Vine. And your website, that has a lot of information and all those maps that I showed and lots more, is at davidvine.net. David, thank you so much for joining us today. This is it's an important conversation that we need to keep having until things change.
I couldn't agree more. And Nicole, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thanks, Nicole.
You too. Bye-bye. All right. Bye. And with that, we're just about at the end of the program. I got to tell you, tomorrow I will not be here. It's my husband's birthday. And frankly, it's going to be our first date night, our first night out since, you know, the pandemic. So we're going to go out to dinner. We're going to go to see the art exhibit of Rick Allen, who was on the show last week. But I will be back Friday. Tomorrow I'll have a best of. I'll run something. It'll be audio only, so no video tomorrow. on Friday, we're going to speak with an acquaintance, a friendly acquaintance of mine, somebody who's very wealthy and is a big liberal Democratic donor, who believes that the Democrats are going to run the table in 2022 and 24. I figured we could use a dose of optimism. I certainly need it. I don't necessarily agree with him, but we need to hear his viewpoint. So that'll be the discussion on Friday. We'll try to end the week with a note of optimism. All right, have a great day tomorrow, and I'll talk to you on Friday. Thanks, everybody. Bye. And I shouldn't leave without giving you what's news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Office of New York Attorney General Letitia James announced Tuesday an expansion of their investigation into the former guy, saying, quote, "We have informed the Trump Organization that our investigation into the company is no longer purely civil in nature." Spokesperson Fabian Levy continued, quote, "We are now actively investigating the Trump Organization in a criminal capacity, along with the Manhattan District Attorney. We have no additional comment at this time." The investigation is reportedly centering in on whether Trump took tens of millions of dollars in tax deductions that he wasn't entitled to. The Manhattan DA has been investigating Trump and his employees to determine if the company committed financial crimes. The House of Representatives is set to vote Wednesday afternoon on legislation setting up an independent, bipartisan commission to investigate the Capitol insurrection. The bill was negotiated in a bipartisan manner between Benny Thompson, the Democratic chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, and the Republican ranking member of the committee, John Katko, who was tasked with making a deal by House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Well, despite the fact that Katko was able to get just about everything McCarthy demanded, McCarthy came out and said he would vote against it. And then on Tuesday night, the orange one released a statement ordering his Republican minions in Congress to resist because he's banned from social media. Trump released a statement that read in part, quote, "It is just more partisan unfairness, and unless the murders, riots, and firebombings in Portland, Minneapolis, Seattle, Chicago, and New York are also going to be studied, this discussion should be ended immediately." Meanwhile, Axios is reporting that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has also fallen in behind Trump and McCarthy and told his colleagues that he, too, will not be supporting the bill as it currently stands. And now a bit of good news. Average COVID-19 case numbers in the U.S. are at the lowest point they've been in almost a year. And a White House advisor says case tallies are down in all 50 states. That points to the fact that the vaccination efforts are working, even as demand for the shots slows across the country. About 48% of the U.S. population has gotten at least one shot. Internationally, there are mixed results. After a devastating lack of vaccine supply and a horrific third wave of infections, Canada is set to catch up and maybe even surpass the U.S. in first dose vaccination rates. But still, only 4% of Canada's eligible population is fully vaccinated. In China, a fresh COVID-19 scare quickly led to 100 million inoculations in just 9 days. But the situation in India is really bad. On Wednesday, India confirmed 4,529 COVID-19 deaths in the previous 24 hours. That is the highest single-day death toll reported by any country during this pandemic. The previous record, by the way, was set here in the U.S. back in January when 4,468 people died in one day. After stonewalling the public and refusing to release body cam video of the police killing of Andrew Brown Jr. in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, the Pasquotank County District Attorney held a press conference on Tuesday. He said that the deputies who killed Brown last month were justified in using deadly force. Then he played video of the incident publicly for the first time, which appears to show the officers opening fire as Brown was driving away, when no cops were in danger of being hit by a moving car. Attorneys for Brown's family are now asking the Justice Department to intervene. They likened the shooting to an execution and say the newly released body cam video proved the shooting was, quote, unequivocally unjustified. So there is legislation in Congress that would overhaul the nation's policing laws. A bipartisan group of House and Senate negotiators met to try to craft a compromise bill. President Biden has said he wants it on his desk by May 25th, the anniversary of George Floyd's death. But the group says it's not adhering to any deadline. So Washington Governor Jay Inslee isn't waiting on Congress. On Tuesday, Inslee signed into law a dozen police reform measures, saying they will work in coordination with one another to create a system of accountability and integrity stronger than anywhere else in the nation. Police chokeholds, neck restraints, and no-knock warrants are now banned in Washington state, and officers are required to step in if they witness colleagues using excessive force. The bill also restricts the use of tear gas, creates an independent office to evaluate the use of deadly force, and makes it easier to sue officers who cause injury. Palestinian protesters gathered by the thousands in cities across the West Bank on Tuesday, calling for mass strikes to convince political leaders to stop the Israeli airstrikes that have pummeled the region in the last 2 weeks. Attacks between Israel and Hamas militants continue, though, making this the deadliest Israeli-Palestinian confrontation since the two sides fought a war in 2014. Israel briefly allowed trucks carrying international aid into Gaza for the first time since the conflict began, but authorities ended up halting them in response to mortar fire at two border crossings. On top of it all, the Ministry of Health in Gaza warned that the destruction of medical facilities could lead to a surge of COVID-19 cases among those fleeing to shelters. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Jordanian King Abdullah II added their voices to those supporting a ceasefire. President Biden, facing lots of calls from Democrats to push harder for that ceasefire, has reportedly been privately encouraging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to start slowing down the airstrikes. And breaking Wednesday morning, Punchbowl News is reporting that President Biden spoke again with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. The two leaders had a detailed discussion on the state of events in Gaza, Israel's progress in degrading the capabilities of Hamas and other terrorist elements, and ongoing diplomatic efforts by regional governments and the U.S. The president conveyed to the prime minister that he expected a significant de-escalation today on the path to a ceasefire. Stay tuned. And finally, a bit of good news. The House on Tuesday passed a bill seeking to strengthen the federal response to hate crimes against Asian Americans. The vote was 364 to 62. Yes, all 62 no votes were from Republicans, but that cleared the way for President Biden to sign the bill into law. It passed overwhelmingly by the Senate with only Josh Hawley opposing it. The bill introduced by Senator Mazie Hirono and Congresswoman Grace Meng would establish a Justice Department position to expedite the review of hate crimes, encourage states to establish hate crime hotlines, and provide money to train law enforcement officers and educate the public on how to counter bias against Asian Americans. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.